you don't have to invent it all yourself. Learn what people have done. Hear what they've thought about in their designs. Think about what you think about your demographics and the services you're going to provide, and see if you can, you know, add value to what they've already thought about, because people are out there thinking about it. I know in the U.S. we can get a little bit insular sometimes about, well, if we didn't think of it ourselves, of course, we wouldn't look to these other countries. But that's actually not true in healthcare design. There's a lot of countries that are doing some very, very interesting hospital designs, and I think we need to learn from that and sort of picture what the U.S. is going to look like 10 years from now.
Welcome back to another episode of Pop Health Podcast, quite possibly the last podcast remaining without a ZipRecruiter ad. I'm your host, Zach Morgan. Today, I'm excited to share our conversation with Senior Vice President and CEO of Keck Medicine of USC, Tom Jackowitz. Tom has built quite a reputation for himself, leading some of the most prestigious academic medical centers throughout the country over his career. And today, we're going to talk to him about leading through what has been a turbulent year for USC's medical school, and also his thoughts on building the hospital of the future, and how he uses football metaphors to motivate his team. As always, thanks so much for listening, and we hope you enjoy. So Tom, thanks for having us. As we like to begin each episode, can you tell the audience something that they might not know about you, maybe something outside of work?
Yeah, there are two things really. So number one, I like to travel. And I like to travel and I like to go to foreign countries and put myself in different situations. I think in healthcare, especially with all the changes that are happening, we tend to get very downward focused and focused on our industry. I think it's important in leadership to have a moment where you can pull back and start to really see the world from different eyes in different places, because in leadership, perspective really matters. The second part about it is I'm a football fan. I'm a New York Giants fan, and I like to use football metaphors at work. And everybody who works for me kind of knows that because I think there are some things about football that really apply to leadership and organizations.
Yeah. Any particular go-tos that your staff has probably heard more than once?
Well, my current one is playing in a broken pocket. And this came up from an interview about the Giants and Eli Manning about the importance of your quarterback being able to play in a broken pocket. For the non-football fans who are listening, when the pass rush comes in and the quarterback then has to improvise and step up in the pocket and make a play, it's an important thing rather than just having a sort of an established pocket. And right now in healthcare with all the changes, and the changes are coming fast and furious, you've got to be able to play in a broken pocket because you've got to be willing to improvise as the changes come.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned your love for the New York Giants. You have quite a diverse background. Can you give the audience a little bit of an idea of your background and what brought you here to this point?
Well, you know, it's always as you get more senior in your career, the moments of reflection of how this all worked out. So I started in healthcare at the University of Pennsylvania in the medical group. And then I got a job in the Department of Medicine at Penn, then opportunity at Stanford within the Department of Medicine, and then I had a chance at the school level with UCSD, and then a CEO of the medical center. Then here is the USC system, and it sort of really worked out. And in the meantime, I went to Columbia for graduate school and got an MPH, and I have an undergraduate degree from the University of Georgia in accounting. And if you ask me at like 18 or 19, this is what I was going to do. I'd be in healthcare and a healthcare CEO. I would have been very thrilled, but I would have said, well, I'm not exactly sure how I'm going to get there. But there are opportunities in life, and I think that's the important part about it. The thing that I always like to reflect on is that it's really about, I mean, the importance of like working really hard and really sort of, you know, you've got to be smart enough to take all the sort of the various details in. You got to work hard, but you've also got to get along with people. Those people skills are the things that get minimized. And they don't tell you enough about this in school, about the importance of dealing with people with diverse educational backgrounds, different demands. You know, here at SC, because I'm dealing with the university, dealing with hospital staff, physicians, the School of Medicine, the School of Pharmacy, other hospital CEOs, insurance companies, hospital association. It really, those people skills are absolutely critical.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's enough focus early on in people's development around what it's going to take to really work effectively across multiple constituencies.
Yeah, we actually have had a few different leaders of healthcare organizations on, and I always think it's interesting to see some of them have a clinical background and then some of them have the healthcare business background like yourself. How do you manage that part without having a clinical background?
So I there are doctors and nurses that I work very closely with, and we trust, they bring a knowledge base that I don't have. And so I'm very good about asking a lot of questions and understanding it and hearing their perspectives and providing the balance, right? Because, of course, there's a lot of other things going on, but it's really, at the end of the day, this is about the patients. And you want to make sure every decision you make is going to improve patient care and it's going to work for the doctors. And hearing their thoughts and the nurses, as well as the pharmacists, social workers, making sure you're hearing from all the clinical caregivers what really matters to them is absolutely critical.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Tom, you mentioned earlier that, you know, you work for the university, you work for the hospital. There's a lot of moving parts in your role, and you actually have dual titles as a senior vice president and CEO for Keck Medicine of USC. Can you shed some light on what those roles entail and how they're different?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it's one I think where in academic medicine, it's critical. And so the SVP title, the Senior Vice President for the University, is really I work for the President of the University. And I say my job is communicating the healthcare needs to the university.
Okay.
Because in talking to the president, the senior leadership of the university, the trustees, because this is a very dynamic industry. It's much different than undergraduate education or some of the basic research that's going on. And so I feel like I've got to be an effective communicator and work very closely with them. And then the CEO job, that's my world here, you know, working with the doctors and the nurses and all our caregivers in terms of providing the best care for the patients. And sort of running this, you know, we're going to be $1.8 billion this year, and we've got about 8,000 or 9,000 employees. That's that world. And so the SVP title is the one that really allows me to take a very large healthcare enterprise and bring it to the university and have those discussions about what we need to be successful.
Okay, good. Now, can you break down maybe some of the challenges that you see at an academic health system versus maybe a non-academic health system?
Or opportunities, yeah, for that matter.
Yeah.
Well, the number one opportunities about being here is, A, we have faculty. And they are very, very special in terms of what they bring, because not only are they great clinicians, but they also have the research and education portion. So they're always on the cutting edge of where healthcare is going to go. Second thing is the brand. And the USC brand is incredibly strong. And it's one thing that we have such a halo from that, because people know USC. They know it from, you know, from obviously from the undergraduate campus, from the film school. You know, the football team helps. I mean, right. People know USC. You know,
yeah, it's like, absolutely.
When you say USC, people know.
Yeah.
And so it gives us, I think, a real heads up. I think the downside of this is the fact that we are a bigger, more complicated organization, because there is that university piece. Like I am explaining to university administration and to the trustees about healthcare and what it really means. And while the brand is really strong, they also worry about things that happen in healthcare that can hurt the brand.
Yeah.
Right? So I've got to sort of convince them in that it is a riskier business than other undergraduate education, right? It's because we're getting insurance contracts. We are really a profit and loss business in that way, right? We've got to generate our own revenue.
Right.
And the other part about this is also, as part of a medical center, you are supporting the School of Medicine and the teaching and research missions there. So you have a more expensive cost base, a more complicated organization to work through, but then you get the halo effect of the brand, and you have the ability to actually have faculty and recruit people that you just couldn't get at other healthcare systems.
Yeah. May I ask, you mentioned recruit people that you couldn't get at other health systems. Have you had folks travel from, I mean, I'm curious where folks have come from to work here.
Yeah. So we have recruited people from any place in the United States, from any, two things. Yeah. People want to come to SC. I always say we can recruit anybody in the country, and we have. So we've gone out and gotten, you know, our stem cell program, our lead scientist there is from Harvard. So he came from Boston to come. We've recruited faculty members really pretty much from every major institution in the country to come here. And it really does help to be in Los Angeles as well. I mean, yeah. People want to be in LA. It's a great city. It's very dynamic. And SC is on the move, and people want to be part of that.
Right.
Very good. So as maybe you haven't experienced in your career previously, or maybe you have, this academic association may have proved challenging, as it has been a pretty turbulent time over the past year for the medical school. From a leadership perspective, what principles do you draw upon or lessons you've learned about guiding a health system or medical group and employees through adversity?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I've had a chance to really test the principles this last year.
Yeah.
Because when the first story on the dean broke in July, we've had really 11 months. Now, we have grown, we've grown about $200 million in revenue. So we've been able to stay focused and continue to grow. And part of this, and my message has been very consistent, our job here is to take care of our patients. And that's why we're here, and that's why people come to see us. And we can never lose that focus. And it has been, those discussions have been very important, because with all the turbulence, it's easy for people to get caught up in the latest newspaper article or the latest news show. But that's not why we're here.
Right.
For the patients that come to see us, they deserve 120% of our attention, and we give it to them. And that's really, really resonated. I think the other part about it is I stay very calm and focused. And I think it's really important to be the leader to stay calm and focused. Because if you're nervous and agitated, I can guarantee you everybody who works for you is going to be nervous and agitated.
Sure.
Absolutely.
And we have an amazing team of professionals here, which, and through all the turbulence, have done, you know, they've done their job. They've done it incredibly well. And I'm very, very proud of the organization.
Nice. Well, you mentioned focusing on patient care earlier. My brother-in-law is a regular visitor of USC KEX. So he's had positive experiences in the past and present, which is great. So it's also been a challenging time for healthcare in America in general. How do you lead just in general, not just with the challenges specifically at USC, but just in general?
Your point's a good one. I think there's been, you know, between the ACA and with President Trump's election and repeal ACA and what's it going to be like, and the idea that they were going to get, you know, we're going to do bundles, we're not going to do bundles. There's been so much conversation in the political arena. This has been very difficult, because you're really trying to predict the future, and you know, I don't really have a Ouija board. But it's again, the thing I always sort of preach are the principles, right? Number one is about patient care. We're here to take care of the patients. We focus on our quality. We focus on our patient satisfaction and patient engagement. And we manage our costs. We'll be okay. Because at the end of the day, those basic principles always work in healthcare.
Yep.
Because you can get really, really caught up in the current political noise. And even recently in the state of California, talking about single payer,
right,
which has huge ramifications across the state. And the thing about it is, it may be implausible, but the fact that people are talking about it publicly, and you've had Bernie Sanders talk about Medicare for All and other things, it's out there, and people realize there's some serious change afoot. Now, the one other thing I'll say about this is the fact that with all this conversation, our organization knows change is happening. So that we've got to be flexible. We've got to be innovative. We got to watch our cost. We've got to do all those things to be ready for change, because you have to be living under a rock to think that there's not going to be change in healthcare.
Right.
And so part of it is a lot of noise, a lot of chaos. At the same point, everybody realizes there's going to be change, and here's our plan, and let's follow our basic principles to be ready for when it comes.
Yeah. Overseeing such a large system, and so you not only have the medical centers, but you have a specialty center like Norris, you have outpatient clinics, you have the medical group. Does that somewhat insulate you from some of those changes, because you can try to control more the entire healthcare picture of a patient, or does it leave you just as exposed or even more exposed?
Well, take a deep breath. I would say that it would probably, it probably doesn't leave us less exposed.
Right.
What the opportunity for us is that we provide, our case mix index is up over 3. It's like 3.1. So the average hospital patient in the U.S. is 1. So we're 3 times as much, and we benchmark against other academic medical centers, and we're the highest in the country. So that says, okay, we are taking care of the sickest of the sick in Los Angeles. And so we know where our strength is. And so in one sense, having like Norris, having CAC, great, you know, cardiovascular program, urology program, neurosurgery program, gives us an opportunity that people are going to come when they really need us, because there's always going to be sick people. The other side of this is with some of the changes that are going on in healthcare around bundled payments and narrow networks, we have to position ourselves to make sure we don't get networked out, and that we are still, that people can still get to us and they're not derailed because of insurance changes and other things.
Sure, sure. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. When you came, you mentioned your time at UCSD, yeah. And then you have come to Keck, to USC after that. When you made that transition, you had mentioned that you felt that USC was in a really exciting period of transition and growth opportunity. What did you see here that really excited you about the opportunity when you came to USC?
So Max Nikias recruited me here, and I realized this was an opportunity I would only see one time in my career anywhere in the country. You had a big brand, you had the second largest city in America, and you had a health system that had just been bought back for the university that was small, but you had a big vision to grow it. And I thought, most times you're going to go to a job that is established and settled, right? You're going to go, you know, I could have left UCSD and went to an established system back east, but it would have never been, but there's a lot of those opportunities. This was a chance to really grow something and make a difference in Los Angeles. And I felt by where we were located here on the eastern side of town, we could deliver something very special. I thought because of the size of this market, that there was a lot of room and opportunity for us to grow.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity.
Yeah. Besides the football analogies, just kind of introspectively, what did you feel that you could really bring to this opportunity?
So a couple things. I feel like when I was at UCSD, we had designed the Jacobs Medical Center, and we'd really created a vision for the La Jolla campus that was very different over the period that I was there. And I felt that I could take that here and use what I learned at UCSD to really create something new here on the east side of Los Angeles. I felt like all the pieces were here. I refer to us as an academic medicine startup because we really were. This was a tenant hospital up until 2009. I got here at the end of 2011, and I thought, this, we're raw, but we have a lot of talented doctors. We have a university with a big vision, and we're in a market where there's a real opportunity to really build this out. And that's what really got me excited. I felt like it could use what I learned at UCSD and take it to a different level here.
Yeah. So you actually mentioned some of the new endeavors that UCSD undertook during your time there and then following your time there. The cardiovascular center that opened, the new Jacobs Center. We've actually been in both of them. We've worked in both of them. And just from on a firsthand account, they are both beautiful and very tech-forward, modern healthcare spaces. You've mentioned, I think, that there's some plans. Well, you just opened Norris here, which is a state-of-the-art center in its own right. But I think there are also some plans to build what I think you had called maybe a hospital of the future over the next decade or so. Drawing on that experience, how do you make a hospital of the future when technology and advances in healthcare change so quickly so that when you open it, it's not already obsolete?
It's really the biggest challenge. And, you know, I toured the Jacobs Medical Center after it was built, and I realized things that I would have done differently, because then we were thinking about all the stuff that we could do. And you realize, even as you get a lot of smart people in the room and really begin to think about it, it's amazing because of the length of time it takes to build a hospital that you feel like when you walk in, I would change this today, I would change that today. So that said, when you look at, so there's a few things. Number one, the demographics. We are an aging society. So we know that we are going to take care of more people that are going to be older and sicker in hospitals. Number two is so much is moving ambulatory. So certain services like orthopedics and things like that are going to, most of that's going to be done in an ambulatory setting within 10 years, except when, because people are living a lot longer, you get your hip replaced at 50, you're going to be coming back for that revision at 85. And so we're going to be doing complicated surgery on very old people. And that is going to be, that is going to be complicated. So then the other part about this is, so in terms of aging societies, countries like Japan and even Europe are ahead of us in the aging process. They have a bigger population. I think it's going to be really important to look at designs in other countries and how they've really thought about it. The Japanese are doing some very interesting things with robotics in terms of how to take care of older and sicker patients, because also their workforce is getting older, right? So you got to pick up, move people. And so my sense is I am shameless about this, is about, you don't have to invent it all yourself. Learn what people have done. Hear what they've thought about in their designs. Think about what you think about your demographics and the services you're going to provide, and see if you can, you know, add value to what they've already thought about, because people are out there thinking about it. I know in the U.S. we can get a little bit insular sometimes about, well, if we didn't think of it ourselves, of course, we wouldn't look to these other countries. But that's actually not true in healthcare design. There's a lot of countries that are doing some very, very interesting hospital designs, and I think we need to learn from that and sort of picture what the U.S. is going to look like 10 years from now. And I will tell you, we are going to have the patients in our hospital are going to be older and sicker. Our 3.1 CMI could be 3.8 or 4,
yeah,
because of the people that we're taking care of. And we're going to be, and for every, the other thing is that everybody is going to need a hospital at some point in their life. It's just, we're going to get sick.
Right.
So case mix index, can you define that maybe for a frontline worker who may not work behind the scenes with analyzation?
So Medicare reimbursement, and this was a system that was developed with the DRG system. They came up with this case mix index. It was really a resource utilization methodology. And what they did is they defined as 1.0 is the average inpatient in the U.S. So then it multiplies after that. So if you have a case mix of 3, that means our inpatients at CAC are 3 times sicker than the average American hospital patient. And so it is a relative model of illness and resource utilization for those patients.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to switch gears and ask you a couple of leadership questions following the break. Sure. So switching gears just a little bit, as a leader yourself, what book or books do you recommend when asked?
You know, it's and this is one that evolves over time depending on what's sort of going on in the industry. And I'm also a believer that don't just read healthcare books, because again, then you get into that very siloed thinking and we get kind of caught up in our own noise. The book that I actually recommend today is a book called April 1865. Fascinating historical read about the end of the Civil War, and with Lincoln's assassination and the Confederacy surrendering, just the general chaos and the decisions that were made to get the United States back on track. I think it's a really important about leadership and doing the right thing in times of crisis. And it's a fascinating read, and it's one that just sort of puts things in perspective. When we talk about, I think we always think of our whatever current time this is as being the most chaotic, and then you really realize that's not the case. But people have always stood up and done the right thing when it was needed to really keep the country, really making the country that it's the success it is now.
What is the best piece of advice that you've ever received?
The best piece I ever got was my mentor, who I first worked with at Penn, and I worked with him again at UCSD, when he said, "Don't make any decision that you can't read on the front page of the paper." And as you can see, it is very, very true. It was true 20 years ago when he said it, and it's incredibly true now. It's because it's an important thing. At the end of the day, it's a real good check about it. And yeah, sometimes we'll try to make decisions that are convenient or whatever, but you have to really realize, step back, let's get a perspective, and let's do the right thing.
Absolutely. On the other side, what is maybe the worst piece of advice or most outdated piece of advice that you've received?
So when I was getting sort of early in my career, kind of the style of management that people were teaching was sort of the sort of command and control style, which I look back and I just shake my head. It's just ridiculous, right? There's way too much information and things move way too quickly as a leader to really think you can like know everything and make every decision. So you have to trust your direct reports. You got to get data disseminated in the organization so everybody's in a position to make important decisions. And you've got to live with the fact that, you know, as a leader, you have to trust your people. And that's where the values are so important, to make sure that people realize what you're going to expect and the value of the decision and not the specific decision.
Yeah. So you actually kind of took the words out of my mouth in asking what the most important qualities of a leader are. And I think trust is a major part of that. So I'll tweak the question a little bit to your football analogy. Yeah. Do you see yourself in a leadership position more as a quarterback or a head coach, or maybe like a general manager of a team? How do you view your leadership responsibilities here?
Yeah, I view myself more as the head coach. You know, and so Bill Parcells, when he was coach of the Giants, said, my job as coach is to put my players in the best position to win. That is actually right on the money. And that's how I always think about it, is what can I do to make sure everybody's in a position to be successful? Because, you know, and again, you don't want your running back playing defensive end,
right?
So you've got to make sure, understand who your running backs are, who your defensive ends are, and make sure you have people in the right positions and you can be successful. It was like one of those moments when I watch these interviews, and a lot of times football coaches will hit you with a zillion platitudes. And occasionally there's these nuggets. It's like, oh my God, that's actually really good.
Yeah. Unless it's Bill Belichick.
Oh, my God.
Then you're probably not getting
so the crazy thing was, he was a defensive coordinator for those Giants teams in the 80s and early 90s. And, yeah, but he wasn't doing many interviews.
No.
Nice. Well, you talked about putting yourself in the best position to win.
Right.
So we understand you're a tech-forward individual. So this could be on the professional side or personal side. Many of us use apps in our day-to-day life. Yeah. So what app would you say puts you in the best position to be successful, either personally, could be sports knowledge, whatever? And if that app was gone, wow, there's an impact on your life. What app would you say has the most impact?
Well, okay, so the couple things. Okay, number one, I have my NewJersey.com app so I can stay up on Giants news. So I do that. But, nice. The ones that I think that are, to me, and this is important for healthcare, is banking apps. Because every time I use my banking app, I think how much that has changed my life. Like, I don't really ever go to a bank anymore. I'm sure most people in the country don't go to banks anymore.
Yeah.
You go to your app and you can do almost everything. You can pay your bills. You can make deposits. You can do everything on your phone. We've got to move more and more in healthcare to the fact of being more convenient for people. You know, it's the thing I always say is that, you know, in ambulatory care, when you come to see a doctor – so this is very Los Angeles specific, but pretty much everybody drives for an hour.
Right.
Then they park, they wait. So you'll say that's another half an hour. And then they have a 15-minute appointment. And then you got to go do it all again.
Right.
What else in your life would you spend 3 or 4 hours doing for 15 minutes of value?
Yeah.
And I think in healthcare, we've got to realize what happened in banking, where people used to go to the bank and now people don't. People are going to want a lot of their healthcare delivered in a very similar way. They're going to want their healthcare delivered where they are and when they want it, and not from 8 to 5 Monday through Friday at certain locations. And I think that's going to be the part of the transformation that we're going to see. And, you see these things with the J.P. Morgan, Berkshire Hathaway, Amazon.
Right? Yeah.
And I think that's what we're going to see. The convenience of healthcare is going to increase significantly, and I think people are going to gravitate to it, and they should, because you know, there's the one thing about modern life. There's a lot of inconveniences, but one of the things we like is the ability to get services where we want. And if you really want to get an idea how quickly things can change, look what's happened to shopping malls.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And to retailers.
Right.
People have used Amazon and they go online and they want to shop from their living room. They don't really want to be walking around places.
Yeah. So in healthcare, there's a ton of technology available, and startups, people I'm sure pitching the hospital all the time. I get pitched a lot in my day-to-day, but it seems like technology hasn't really had a tipping point yet, at least from my perspective, from what I hear from others. And I'm curious if you agree with that, and what potential innovations excite you that might lead us to that tipping point.
So you're absolutely right about it. We have not reached that tipping point. And in sort of my view of the world, and it could be relatively narrow, there's some really interesting technologies about mining some of our data, healthcare data, within hospitals to improve quality and patient safety and reduce our costs. Because as healthcare organizations, we have a mountain of data. We haven't used it very effectively in terms of, like, are we really changing the way we're treating patients and really improving things? And I would say yes, but nowhere near the opportunity. So there's some really good, and part of the challenge is we still have dictation. So we have unstructured data that goes in, which becomes more difficult to pull out in a usable format. Some of these new data mining tools actually will help us sort of aggregate unstructured data. Very exciting. On the patient, so of course the patient engagement is actually critical. We're really evaluating today a company that provides AI primary care, so artificial intelligence. And while the company is coming out of the UK, you know, we've done work here with the Department of Defense in developing avatars and other things to help soldiers returning from the wars with PTSD. So I think there's a real opportunity here, if you wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, to use AI to help evaluate your symptoms. Because again, we're talking about convenience and quality and instant access to healthcare. If you can get a very quick diagnosis at 2 o'clock in the morning, it'll save an emergency room trip or an urgent care trip, and you can get your healthcare when you need it. And I think some of these tools are going to be very important, because when we start talking about the shortages of physicians and other caregivers, how we use AI is going to really matter.
Sure. Yeah, no, good point.
That makes a lot of sense.
So as we wrap up, Tom, LA is pretty hyper-competitive. You mentioned the great opportunity at USC in 2011 when you came. At the same time, you have some great, I guess you may say, competitors or even allies, depending on how you look at it, here in the LA marketplace with healthcare services. How does Keck Medicine of USC differentiate itself, and how do you envision your reputation and differentiators 10 to 20 years from today?
Well, I always refer to LA as kind of the Wild West of healthcare. And there's some things about LA that I think are very important to put out there. Number one, there's a lot of for-profit medicine in LA. And some of the big medical groups like Healthcare Partners, which was bought by DaVita, now it's going to be bought by Optum. So Optum, which is part of United Healthcare, is going to have 1.5 million capitated lives, which is probably, of the non-Kaiser capitated lives, is probably a third of all those lives are going to be there. And for the folks who don't know, Optum, part of what they got kind of got built on was their data analytical tools, and they've got a lot of people really looking at this data. That's going to be really a game changer in this market. In addition, you have Heritage Provider Network, which is a very large physician group that's kind of on the north side of town. And they are still standalone, but they've got the same capabilities. We've also seen Providence come in and acquire the St. Joe's Hoag system.
Right.
And they have the largest number of hospitals here in LA. And of course, you've got Cedars and UCLA doing their thing. And you've got, obviously, but there was like, at one point, there was 99 independent hospitals in the LA market. So it was a really, you know, it was a really non-aggregated market, which is a lot, I think for some inefficiencies to develop, but also to be in a much more competitive environment. Because of that, and not having large systems to be able to sort of control the prices, the cost of healthcare in LA is lower than a lot of other markets because there's been real competition. So having a lot of competition, having a big for-profit, presence, also having Kaiser. I mean, Kaiser in the long run in California has been very effective at keeping the overall price of healthcare, because you could never, your costs could never get that high, because otherwise people would all choose Kaiser.
Right.
So you always have to be competitive. I think all those factors have created, I think, an environment where in some ways we may be seeing the future of healthcare in the U.S. going on in L.A. And while I know people are thinking, okay, California, oh yeah, the Californians always think they're ahead of the game. But this time we may actually be right. And I'm not, and I think LA is a very, because it's like where San Diego and the Bay Area are much more mature.
Right.
They have more large employers. They have very structured health systems. And here, I was looking at the data yesterday. If you take Kaiser out of the market, I think the largest market share on the hospital side is Providence, like 10%.
Yeah.
You know, and I know in San Diego, Sharp's the largest, and they're about 30% of the market. Right. In the Bay Area, the big Sutter is, I think, over 40%.
Yep.
So because of that, that you have a lot of competitors, and cost is part of it. We may be seeing the future of healthcare, and in a way, we've lived with less for longer in LA, so I think we may be better positioned for other changes that may happen at the federal level. You know, I'm sure that at some point, Medicare was going to be made the public option. There's be a lot of reasons to do that, which will mean that you'll have people moving out of commercial products into Medicare, and that'll change the reimbursement in a big way. And while I don't think anybody's truly ready for that moment, I think hospitals in LA probably are closer to it because their cost structures are lower.
Yeah. Okay. Not to mention the geography that you mentioned before. Los Angeles is kind of its own beast on being able to get to certain places. Even the medical center here, I mean, it might only be, you know, 10 or 15 miles from where you are if you're on the west side or something like that. But it can, depending on the time of day, it could take you 20 minutes to get here, or it could take you two hours to get here.
Well, and you're so right about this, because part of it is it's like the mountains and the rivers are the freeways here. Because
right.
traffic, like if you're at Santa Monica at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and you've got to get over here, which is downtown, which we're probably 15 miles,
yeah.
it's actually impossible.
Yeah.
So part of that is you have these natural boundaries driven by the traffic.
Yeah.
And so it allows for opportunity in how you approach the market. You have to understand the traffic patterns in LA and where people can actually drive. I also think it's when we talk about tech and what's going to happen, that convenience factor here is going to really matter. If you're going to try to connect to patients that are part of the KEC system in Santa Monica, you better have very good technology, because they're not going to be able to drive over here every time they need something.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hey, thanks again for sitting down with us. We really appreciate your time. I know I took a lot from this. I know the listeners will as well. And so yeah. Thanks for having us.
Oh, my pleasure. Yeah. It was great. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks.